well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. It is a special edition. We're going to be doing a deep dive in the Supreme Court's decision in U.S. versus Hamani, which came out. It was the first opinion released on Thursday morning. We did not get Wolford versus Lopez, by the way. So the next opinion date for the Supreme Court is next Tuesday. Could be that that's when we get Wolford versus Lopez. But today we got the decision in U.S. versus Hamani, which was the case involving Section 922G3, the federal prohibition on gun possession for unlawful users of drugs. And an essentially unanimous Supreme Court ruled that Section 922G3 is unconstitutional as it applies to the plaintiff in this case, Ali Daniel Hamani, who was charged for regularly using marijuana while possessing firearms. And while Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch, who wrote the majority opinion, stresses that this is a narrow decision, it's not so narrow that it only applies to Ali Daniel Hamani. The way I read this, this applies pretty much to any prosecution solely and merely for using marijuana without any presupposition or any finding of dangerousness or an allegation, I guess, provable evidence of dangerousness on the part of the marijuana user. So what's interesting here is we've got a number of concurrences. As I said, this was essentially a unanimous decision. However, there were various routes by which the justices reached their conclusion. So Justice Gorsuch delivered the opinion of the court, to which Chief Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Thomas, Sotomayor, Chief Justice Roberts, Clarence Thomas, Sotomayor, Brett Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett, and Justice Jackson all joined. Then you had Justice Thomas, who filed a concurring opinion. Justice Jackson filed a concurring opinion with which Justice Sotomayor joined. Samuel Alito wrote a concurring opinion in which he was joined by Justice Kagan, which is kind of an odd pairing. So today we'll go through the majority opinion and we'll touch on those concurring opinions. I'm going to be having more coverage at Bearing Arms as well. But essentially, the government had argued that Section 922G3 was justified because it was part of a national tradition of barring addicts and drunkards from possessing firearms. Justice Gorsuch said that essentially every one of the arguments that the government raised fails. He says that the Second Amendment protects the right of all Americans to keep and bear arms for self-defense, though like much individual rights, it has its limits. To determine when the government infringes on the Second Amendment, the court begins by asking whether the amendment's terms cover the conduct in question, and if so, the Constitution presumptively protects it. To overcome that presumption, the government bears the burden of showing that its regulatory efforts are, quote, consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation. The government, he says, accepts this framework and agrees that 922G3's unlawful user provision burdens conduct that is presumptively protected by the Second Amendment because the statute bans a class of people, including Mr. Hamani, from possessing essentially any firearm for any purpose. Gorsuch goes on to say that the government construes the statute to automatically ban an individual from possessing a gun from the moment he becomes an unlawful user of any controlled substance, and that prohibition remains in effect until he ceases being an unlawful user, regardless of what the controlled substance was, in what amounts it was used, whether his drug use has ever made him a danger to himself or others, why he keeps a gun, or how safely he does so. The government draws an analogy to what it calls the habitual drunkard laws, which it submits enjoy deep roots in the country's history and are, quote, relevantly similar to the regulation that it wishes to enforce. Justice Gorsuch went on to say, these habitual drunkard laws fall into three general categories. Vagrancy laws that allowed habitual drunkards to be confined in workhouses or jailed, civil commitment statutes that allowed courts to appoint guardians for habitual drunkards or authorize their commitment to asylums, and surety laws under which judicial officers could compel habitual drunkards to post surety bonds to ensure their good behavior. Of course, it then says the government's analogy fails on every metric. It invites this court to consider. Taken cumulatively, he says, these problems prove fatal to the government's prosecution of Mr. Hamani. So, starting out, Gorsuch says, the government's claim that historical laws targeted habitual drunkards for the same reason that 922G3 targets unlawful users of drugs, because they regularly use intoxicants, is difficult to square, he says, with the historical record. He notes that around the time of the founding and for decades following, a habitual drunkard was generally somebody who, quote, for any considerable part of his time, was intoxicated to such a degree as to deprive him of his ordinary reasoning faculties. In other words, just because you drank alcohol didn't make you a drunkard. Unlike 922G3, which says one puff and no gun rights for you, right? Justice Gorsuch says that the government's claim that 922G3 disarms unlawful drug users to protect the public from unusually dangerous individuals who will commit violent crimes and that historical laws share a similar purpose misapprehends the purposes animating those historical analogs. The vagrancy laws, for example, usually targeted those who, quote, did not meet the societal expectations of work and sought to promote productivity and suppress various vices, not to protect the public from a category of unusually dangerous persons. Civil commitment laws, by their own terms, generally did not seek to protect the public from violence so much as to protect habitual drunkards from themselves and to protect their families from financial devastation. And the surety of good behavior laws that the government invokes did not normally require a showing that an individual posed a threat of violence. Instead, they sought to protect the community from scandals against good morals. Again, I think different means, but also different ends for those laws that the government cited. Of course, it says that the way habitual drunkard statutes worked in the past also differs significantly from how 922G3's unlawful user provision works today. The historical laws that the government identifies usually provided some form of process before an individual lost any of his liberties, even temporarily. A vagrant could be sent to a workhouse or jail, generally only upon a conviction. A habitual drunkard could be assigned a guardian or committed to an asylum, usually only after proceedings before something like a probate court. And surety statutes typically required a proceeding before a justice of the peace or a comparable officer before a bond could be ordered. By contrast, on the government's account, 922G3 automatically divests an individual of his constitutional right to bear arms the moment he becomes an unlawful user and until he ends his drug use, all without any pre-deprivation process. Of course, it's went on to say that there are reasons to doubt that the government has established the statute even serves the purpose that the government claims of disarming categorically violent and unusually dangerous persons. He writes that the statute's reliance on the Controlled Substances Act, a statute adopted to protect, quote, the health and general welfare of the American people, and under which drugs can be added to schedules for reasons having little or nothing to do with their potential to reduce violence, to induce violence, makes it far from obvious that 922G3 confines its reach to those who are categorically and unusually dangerous. Additionally, the government's own regulatory actions undercut its position. Of course, it says that the Department of Justice has directed federal prosecutors to tail enforcement efforts against marijuana users. Most states have legalized marijuana use to some degree, and the government recently moved to put some marijuana products from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3, affording the government broad power to designate any group as dangerous and therefore disqualify its members from having a gun would risk allowing it to, quote, quickly swallow the Second Amendment. Now, Justice Gorsuch says the court's decision is narrow. It does not address efforts to ban addicts or those presently intoxicated from possessing a firearm. Other prophylactic laws that Congress might adopt after determining that users of a particular drug pose a special risk of misusing firearms. It doesn't address 922G1's provision disarming individuals convicted of felonies, or whether the government could bring a prosecution under 922G3 accompanied by individualized proof that the defendant's drug use renders him a danger to himself or others, or proof that a certain drug always renders its users dangerous. And that's the end of the summary of Justice Gorsuch's position. So again, I think this does indicate that merely because you possess a medical marijuana license, you should not be deprived of your Second Amendment rights. merely because you live in a state in which marijuana is legal for recreational use, you should not lose your Second Amendment rights simply because you imbibe, even on a regular basis. Now, again, if the government can prove that your behavior under the influence does make you dangerous, that you've done dangerous things perhaps while you're under the influence, and they could still arguably bring a challenge under 922G3. But I think it just became a lot harder to do so. And I suspect that the real world implications for this is that those states that have said, well, yeah, if you possess a medical marijuana card, you can't buy a gun, you can't get a concealed carry license. I think those decisions are going to be mooted, perhaps not directly by this decision, but certainly indirectly by this decision. And I think that makes sense. You know, as Gorsuch noted, most of the states in this country have legalized marijuana use to some degree, right? I think 40 states have legalized it for medical marijuana. Not quite as many as constitutional carry states have decriminalized marijuana use for recreational purposes, but pretty close. I think it's about 26 states compared to 29 constitutional carry states. And again, you've got millions of people. There are some surveys that show that marijuana use is actually more popular than alcohol use these days. Should everybody who uses marijuana then be deprived, run the risk of prosecution? As Justice Gorsuch said, run the risk of 15 years in prison simply because they own a pistol and they like to puff up on occasion. So now we get into the concurring opinions. The first one from Justice Clarence Thomas, who says that he agrees that 922G3 violates the Second Amendment as applied to Ali Hamani, and he joins the opinion in full. But he says he writes separately to call attention to another issue. As a matter of both original meaning and this court's precedent, 922G3 appears to exceed Congress's enumerated power to regulate interstate commerce. He says the statute makes it a federal crime for unlawful drug users to possess any firearm or ammunition in or affecting commerce. But under the prevailing interpretation of the statute, the government can secure a conviction for unlawful firearm possession, quote, if the firearm possessed by the drug user had previously traveled in interstate commerce. Clarence Thomas says the Commerce Clause does not authorize Congress to, quote, regulate or ban possession of any item that has ever been offered for sale or cross state lines. He says, so while the issue is not presented in this case, the court and lower courts should revisit the constitutionality of 922G in its entirety, not just G3, which is the unlawful user of drugs, but 922G1, which is the ban on felons or those convicted of a crime punishable by more than a year in prison. He says that entire section criminalizes intrastate gun possession. It makes it a felony for enumerated categories of people to, as relevant here, possess in or affecting commerce any firearm or ammunition. He says that this appears to exceed Congress's powers under the Commerce Clause. It says Congress has the power to regulate commerce among the several states, but lacks the power to regulate the possession of firearms solely on the ground that they crossed state lines at some point in the past. He says, as an original matter, the Commerce Clause authorizes Congress only to, quote, regulate the buying and selling of goods and services trafficked across state lines. It gives Congress no power to regulate activities wholly separated from business, such as gun possession. He says, because 922G criminalizes possession of firearms apart from any purchase or sale of goods and services across state lines, I doubt that it could be an exercise of Congress's Commerce Clause powers as an original matter. So Clarence Thomas, again, taking a unique approach to this, he says, in upholding 922G under the Commerce Clause, the courts of appeals have misapprehended our precedents in two ways. Some believe that the precedential opinions like Scarborough require them to uphold 922G's constitutionality. Others have concluded that the presence of a so-called jurisdictional hook in 922G renders the state constitutional, renders the statute unconstitutional under Lopez and Morrison. He says neither rationale establishes that 922G is constitutional. It is worth noting that Justice Thomas wrote for himself here. No other justice joined his concurring opinion, but I appreciate Justice Thomas's fealty to the Constitution and to the limitations on the powers and authority granted to the various branches of the federal government. Justice Jackson and Justice Sotomayor. Now, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson and Justice Sonia Sotomayor, not fans of the Second Amendment jurisprudence that the Supreme Court has established, right? And we knew this back during oral arguments. Well, we've known this for some time. In the case of Justice Jackson, she complains at any given opportunity that the text, history, and tradition test laid out by Bruin is unworkable, that it needs to be replaced with this, you know, means-end scrutiny, the tiered scrutiny. And this is the crux of her concurring argument. She says she joins the court's opinion in full because it correctly applies her decisions in Bruin and Rahimi. But she says, I continue to believe that we veered off course in Bruin. I write separately to emphasize that means in scrutiny, the approach courts applied before we adopted Bruin's history and tradition metric, offers a more rational way of assessing the constitutionality of firearm regulations. Now, I'm not going to get into her arguments here. I disagree. We have seen abuses under that tiered scrutiny. Of course, we've seen abuses from the courts under the text, history, and tradition standard as well. It is worth noting that Justice Jackson and Sotomayor, I think Acasas Moros pointed this out on X, in their concurring opinion, they do not cast doubt on the Heller decision. They don't say, hey, there is no individual right to keep and bear arms. They simply say that, well, we need to go back to this, you know, rational basis, intermediate scrutiny, strict scrutiny standard rather than the text, history, and tradition. She writes that in a future case that squarely presents the question, we should consider whether to retire the failed Bruin experiment and return to an explicit assessment of Congress's ends and means when deciding the constitutionality of firearm restrictions. And then we get to the last concurring opinion written by Justice Alito, to which Justice Kagan joins. Again, that's an odd pairing, I have to say. And when I was sort of gaming out how I thought this decision would go, I suspected that it was actually going to be a 7-2 decision. I thought that Justice Alito and Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, would actually be in the minority in upholding 922G3, even as it applies to Ali Daniel Hamani. So I did not have it on my SCOTUS bingo card that Sam Alito and Elena Kagan would team up for a concurring opinion. Alito writes that he agrees with the court, that the historical analogs of the government sites are not relevantly similar to 922G3 as applied to respondent. He said, I also agree that nothing in the opinion of the court should be read to cast doubt on the constitutionality of other provisions of 922G. Such as 922G1 and 922G4, the prohibitions on the possession of firearms and the mentally ill, which he says we have repeatedly said are presumptively lawful. He says, although I agree with the court on these points, I would affirm on a different ground from those on which the majority relies. He says, as the opinion of the court explains, the habitual drunkard laws of the government sites did not allow officials to disarm all those who, quote, regularly used intoxicants, or even just those who, quote, sometimes use them to excess. Those laws instead threatened disarmament only for those whose use of an intoxicant, quote, rendered them practically incapacitated and incapable of managing their affairs. Those persons drank so much, so often, that they were incapacitated not only during bouts of drunkenness, but also in a more persistent and pervasive manner. Yet the government argues that these historical analogs establish a regulatory tradition that allows it to disarm, quote, anyone who regularly uses, quote, any amount of marijuana unlawfully. He says the mismatch between the government's historical analogs and the theory on which the government defends the constitutionality of the statute as applied to Ali Daniel Hamani is clear. He says all that we know about Hamani's marijuana use is that he used the drug about every other day. We don't know how much he used. We don't know the strength of the marijuana that he used, how many times he used it on the days in question, the time of day when he used it, where he used it, or the degree to which this use affected his ability to exercise judgment and perform daily tasks responsibly. As a result, Alito, and again joined by Kagan, say that the government has failed to show that a marijuana user like respondent is incapacitated in a way analogous to the habitual drunkards that the government's analogs regulated. He goes on to say that marijuana consumption is increasingly common in this country. Many states have legalized its use and sale, and although possession of the drug remains a federal crime, very few persons are convicted of that offense each year. The government has largely tolerated the production and sale of marijuana when done in accordance with state law, and it has allowed a multi-billion-dollar marijuana business to develop. For its part, Congress has restricted the use of appropriated funds to prevent states from implementing laws that allow the use, distribution, possession, or cultivation of medical marijuana, or to prosecute certain parties that produce, distribute, or possess marijuana in compliance with state law. In these circumstances, he says, marijuana use today is like alcohol use was at the founding. It's widespread and increasingly considered socially acceptable in many quarters. And from a practical standpoint, law enforcement widely tolerates the use of marijuana. He says these similarities underscore the deficiency of the government's analogs. To succeed, the government would need to identify a regulatory principle that justified the disarmament of persons who are relevantly similar to the occasional marijuana user. But whereas the government's analogs allowed disarmament only of those whose extreme use of an intoxicant incapacitated them habitually, 922G3 is applied to the respondent and allows disarmament of those who do more than regularly use a similar intoxicant unlawfully. He says, in attempting to rebuff a Second Amendment challenge, the government need not identify a historical twin or a precise precursor. Still, he says, the government must cite analogs that are, quote, relevantly similar, and that therefore furnish a basis for inferring that a challenge law is consistent with the historical understanding of the right that the Second Amendment codified. Here, the government's analogs are too far afield to justify the application of 922G to a marijuana user like the respondent. He says, we need not say more to decide this case, and I, for that reason, would say no more. I would accordingly affirm on this ground alone. Which I think, again, I mean, that is a concurring opinion. And I would say that was one of, it certainly was one of the main reasons written in Justice Gorsuch's majority opinion. Right, that the analogs that the government offered simply don't fit the facts of this case. But I guess Justice Alito needed to put that on the record that nobody could accuse him of, being pro-drug use. Again, kind of surprised that Justice Kagan signed on to that and not signed on to the concurring opinion authored by Ketanji Brown Jackson that Sonia Sotomayor joined. Kagan may actually be coming around a little bit on the Second Amendment. Remember, Mexico versus Smith and Wesson, Kagan wrote the opinion for a unanimous court that rejected Mexico's lawsuit against U.S. gunmakers. Kagan noted that the AR-15, the most popular rifle in the country today, lawfully possessed by millions of people. So I don't know that I'd go so far as to say that Kagan's going to be a vote to declare that bans on so-called assault weapons are unconstitutional. But if there was one member of the liberal/progressive wing of the Supreme Court who would do so, I think it would be Kagan. And it's interesting, again, that she joined Justice Alito in this concurring opinion. So, bottom line is this is, I think, good news for gun owners. It's good news for the Second Amendment. If you are a user of PCP, if you regularly use meth, if you regularly smoke crack cocaine, I wouldn't run out there and make that public statement about, yes, I do these things and I'm a gun owner. I wouldn't go that far. But again, I think if you are one of the millions of Americans who possess a medical marijuana card, and you want to exercise your right to bear arms. Now, some states may not get rid of that conflict immediately. You might have to sue, but you can, I think, point to the decision in Hamani to say, listen, what you're doing violates my rights. And in fact, I wouldn't be surprised if we actually see some follow-up suits based on the Hamani decision, because there are some states that say it's one or the other. You've got your medical marijuana card or you've got your concealed carry license. You can't have both. I don't think the Hamani decision allows for that. Again, not unless there is some particularized finding, and it can't be subjective based on the Bruin test, right? You've got to have an objective finding that an individual's marijuana use makes them dangerous. And it's not simply because they use marijuana. So this probably won't clear up all of the confusion right away, but I think this will ultimately lead to those state-level laws that say you've got to choose between one or the other to go away, or at least to be revised substantially. In states, again, where marijuana has been legalized or decriminalized for recreational use, again, I mean, based on what Justice Gorsuch wrote, there should not be any prohibition in the law that says if you light up a joint, you can't own a gun. And prosecutions under 922 G3 may continue, but it sounds like not just for marijuana, but for other drugs, the government is going to have to make a particularized finding of dangerousness against the defendant. They're going to have to offer proof that Joe Blow's use of blow has made him a danger to himself and others. Or perhaps the Supreme Court left open the idea that you know, the government could still use 922 G3 to say that use of a particular drug inherently makes a user so dangerous that they should not possess firearms. But I think that door has been closed when it comes to making that argument against marijuana use. So there you go. U.S. versus Hamani decided pretty much the way I thought that it would be. How we got there, interesting. And the essentially unanimous decision from the court, I think, again, truly surprising. Although it's worth noting that Justice Jackson and Justice Sotomayor would have sided with Ali Daniel Hamani, maybe not even on Second Amendment grounds, but certainly under a different standard than what the majority of the court used. So now we turn our attention to Wolford versus Lopez. As I said at the beginning of the program today, next Tuesday is the next opinion day for the Supreme Court. There are, I believe, 17 cases this term that are still outstanding. There are some big ones out there. Got the birthright citizenship issue, Wolford versus Hawaii, which is the Wolford versus Lopez, which is the vampire rule issue. We don't know what cases are going to come out next Tuesday, but we'll be closely watching at 10 a.m. next Tuesday when the justices return to the bench and start reading out more opinions. But there you go, U.S. versus Hamani, a win for gun owners, a victory for the Second Amendment. And frankly, I think a win for common sense as well. All right. Because we've done such a deep dive on Hamani, we won't do an armed citizen story today or a recidivist report or a good deed. We'll save those for Monday. But I do want to thank you for being a part of the program. As always, we are going to have a written deep dive into these concurring opinions at BearingArms.com. I would encourage you to check that out. And, of course, all of the coverage of other Second Amendment news and issues. In fact, we've got another story out of Hawaii. Not dealing with the vampire rule, but the gun-free zones that are government buildings in Hawaii. A incident reveals just how useless that designation really is. I would encourage you to check that out. And again, we'll be back with another edition of Bearing Arms Cayman Company on Monday. Be sure to check out the website between now and then, keeping you covered with every aspect of your right to keep and bear arms. And if you like what you see, I would encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold or VIP Platinum member. Use the promo code FIGHT and take 60% off your membership. You get all kinds of great benefits no matter what tier of support you choose. And you'll be supporting the work that we do no matter what tier you choose. And we greatly appreciate that support. It means a lot. Enjoy the rest of your Thursday, however you may choose to celebrate the Hamani decision. And we'll see you back here soon. Until then, be well. Be safe. And be free.